Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Dunzo. This is a podcast that explores hookups and breakups of famous lovers and friends, both real and fake, and all the discarded pop culture of yesteryear. I'm your host, Troy McEady. You guys, welcome to another episode of Dunzo. It is me, Troy McEady, and I am very, very excited for this episode. It has been a long time coming. What you guys don't realize is that it's taken us a little while to orchestrate the recording of this episode because we live in different parts of the world. But I am joined by one half of the Sissy That Pod podcast. Kian, how are you?
Good, Troy. Thank you so much for having me here. Should I say good morning, Troy?
Good morning, Kian.
No, I'm excited to talk. Although I prepared myself for this episode a while ago, I had to refresh myself today. But I'm ready to go. I'm ready to kick ass.
I'm really excited for this. So we are talking about Charlie's Angels today. Of course, the 2000 remake of the show, executive produced by Drew Barrymore and her production company. And I have talked about this movie in passing on this podcast. A few years ago, I did a Drew Barrymore and Tom Green relationship episode. And I talked about the production of this movie and like what it meant to Drew's career, but I didn't get to really expand on it in the way that a millennial homosexual would like to expand on it, right? So I'm really excited for this. And I'm excited to learn like what this movie meant to you growing up.
Yeah, like it's one of those things that I always think that what is it nature or nurture, the things that us as gay men are obsessed with? That it's like, mm-hmm. you take two boys, opposite side of the world, different backgrounds, mm-hmm. both show them this movie and they both become obsessed with it. And yeah, it's one of those, like, so I was about 10 probably when I watched it for the first time, loved it. Considered it was high art, wasn't sure why no one else seemed to think it was as good a movie as I did.
Yeah.
And it was just thought it was so, I don't like, I was also a big James Bond fan, but this like clicked another part of my brain, which was just like, it was the music, it was the costumes, it was everything. It was, yeah, it was really sort of an instant love affair with these movies.
I agree with that. This is a movie that I think most people can relate to this, especially if you grew up with like, in the era of like DVDs being really expensive and like coming off of like VHS tapes as like a kid. This was a movie that I used to like rewind and just rewatch over and over, or I would like skip. I would just randomly be like, I want to watch this random scene from Charlie's Angels. And I would just like watch a random fight scene or skip to the part that I love. Like it was a movie that was almost constantly a part of my rotation. I probably would watch it at least like a few times a month, if not like once a week at the height of owning it. I was just obsessed with it. I never got sick of it. And you're right, I always wonder that kind of stuff. Like there are so many, the last time I posted clips from this on my Instagram, so many people and like a lot of little gay boys were like, this was the moment for me as a kid. And I don't know what that is, but something about this just resonates.
Yeah, definitely. Like, so you mentioned at the top that I do a Drag Race reaction podcast, Sissy That Pod. But my co-host and I have also started a second podcast called Queer Classified. And in that we take movies and TV shows, we try break down what is the queer appeal and does it do it correctly. So now that I kind of have that hat on, I was trying to look at this movie in terms of what is the queer appeal. And I think for men anyway, and I guess to queer women too, and I think this is also what makes it appeal to women, is these women sort of exist in these world where they get all the affection from the men, but there's never any danger. They are rising above this world of men. All the men in it are blithering idiots. They're stupid. They can't get anything done. Even like the mastermind villain is a woman as well. And I just think it's like these women kicking their way through the patriarchy, I think, like, and looking good while doing it and having kick-ass background music, I think is instant queer appeal.
I agree with that. It's undeniable almost. And I think it's really important to note, like, right off the top that, so this movie was directed by Mick G. And at the time, this movie came out in the year 2000. And at the time, up to that point, I think Mick G was only known for directing music videos and, like, really glossy commercials. Like, he had done some Gap commercials, but mostly he did music videos. And I just think, first of all, this movie feels like a really long music video. Like, I think it's very obvious that the director had just come from doing these, like, very glossy, you know, MTV music videos, because it looks like one. And it was the perfect time for a movie like that to be released, the year 2000. You know what I mean? Like, TRL is at its peak. We are, like, very much living in, like, an MTV world. And then this movie comes out, which is basically just, like, a really long, very glossy, like, expensive music video.
Which is a fun, because the actual song associated with the TV show had a really cheap music video.
Right. A CGI music video. Yeah. I know. I was thinking that. I was like, God, if it would have been really cool to see, like, Destiny's Child doing, like, the army crawl with, like, the hat, like, you know, like, the sets of this film. Why didn't they do that? There's three of them.
It's just that those awful computer graphics that they're sort of, they just feel like they're living inside a mouse of a computer. It's just all very strange.
Inside a mouse. But no, it's really, you know, it's, when I was watching this back, I was like, God, they don't make movies like this anymore. It's bright, it's overly saturated, it's colorful, it's like very designed set pieces. Like, it's not meant to live in any version of reality. It's just like this dream. It honestly reminds me of like if the Spice Girls Say You'll Be There video was like a full feature length film.
Is that not Dune? No. You're right though. It's almost like secret agent drag in a way. It's like so over the top and expressive and so unrealistic, but purposefully so. And in the same way, like in the opening shot scene of the movie when you're following LL Cool J around a plane, and then like he parachutes off it to reveal that actually it's one of the Charlie's Angels. It's just Drew Barrymore, right? Underneath it.
Yeah.
But you're just like, what? How would Twitter of 2022 react to that if that came out right now? Like, I couldn't imagine it.
There's so many moments where I'm like, if this came out right now, this movie would be dragged. Oh my God. Like Drew ripping off a black man's face and then being underneath. But like, at the time, it was just all so, like, the early 2000s of it all is so palpable in this movie. Like, it is one of the most early 2000s movies to ever exist, I feel. It's just so heightened, you know, everything.
And, like, that's a clear reference to Mission Impossible with the mask. And I can't think of movies, I can't think of a movie that's come out in the last 5 years that within it has a direct reference to a movie that came out 5 years previously. Like Mission Impossible was only what, late 90s, and that's clearly, like, this movie is clearly referencing Matrix and Mission Impossible throughout it in this sort of fun parody way. And they don't, like you said, they don't make movies like that anymore. Movies don't enter conversations with other movies as direct comparisons. They're like always trying to fight for their individuality.
So before we get into, because I have so many notes about the fighting scenes, I have so many notes about all of those things. Yeah. I want to talk about the casting.
Cool.
Off the top, right? Yeah. So this is a really stacked cast. Yes. It's really incredible. And everybody pulls their weight. Nobody in this movie feels like an afterthought. Everybody is so perfectly cast. And they all, like the three leads, Lucy, Drew, and Cameron, they all kind of feel like these like cartoon versions of themselves as we know them as like public figures, like these heightened, like Powerpuff Girl versions of themselves. And I think it's really smart the way that they wrote it to kind of like, their characters all kind of play to their own strengths as actors, I feel.
Yeah, I never got to watch the TV show growing up. Like, I think I remember it being on some of the network channels here, but I don't think I really watched it properly. Do you know whether the characters in this echoed the TV show?
I never really watched the TV show either. This was my intro.
Yeah, me too.
You know what I mean? Like, what
couldn't
I know
go back to Farrah Fawcett after I had Cameron Deej, you know?
Right. I know. I was going to say the only thing I know of the show really is just like the iconic imagery of Farrah Fawcett, honestly.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, like, I really do like the individuality, and you get that sort of in the opening segment, which is Cameron Diaz is the nerd, which I think great. Cast the blonde as a nerd. What a perfect juxtaposition of like stereotypes of high school. Then you have you have Lucy Liu as like the pristine upper class hoity-toity girl, and then you just have Dylan as the kick-ass rebel without a cause. And it's like perfect. You set the scene so quickly in that really quick montage, and that goes on to sort of, you know, what they all bring to the table throughout. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, they all sort of like counter each other in a really interesting way. And it feels believable, you know, like it feels like it was written by people who actually knew these women. Like, you can tell that Drew was very much a part of it, and she's injected like so much of their own identities into it. It feels like they got to maybe choose like what their characters' identities were, like the traits that they would have. Mm. Like, it just feels very lived in, you know.
It feels very like action role play or whatever, where it's like, I'm choosing a level 7 mage who's upper class.
Yes.
And horse riding. You know, you just picture them coming to set being like, I'm deciding to play this as a nerd who's actually a super hot cheerleader. It's like, cool, let's go with it.
And they're like, wait, you guys, I just figured out my girl does bombs. She like detonates bombs. She knows wires, like, right? And they're like, yeah, red, blue wire. Yeah.
Like, one of the biggest laughs for me is when they're trying to find Bosley and he's in Carmel, and it's identified because Cameron Diaz's character can identify the type of chirping bird in the background and then recreates the noise. Oh, it's the blue-titted something.
Yeah.
And you're like, all right, wow.
Literally creates the most perfectly pitched bird noise I've ever heard by simply cupping her hand over her mouth and then hitting the other side of it. I was like, wow, that's really something.
At one point, I think she speaks Japanese, and then maybe Lucy Liu speaks Chinese, maybe that's it. And then Cameron D responds in like German, and then Drew Barrymore responds in Swedish, and they're all just like nodding away to each other, and Sam Rockwell's just looking on going, say, what the fuck is this?
Okay, and can we talk about the side characters really quick? Like the Sam Rockwells, the fucking Crispin Glovers, the
Matt LeBlanc.
I mean,
I totally forgotten he was in that.
Me too. Bill Murray.
Yeah. Luke Wilson.
Luke Wilson.
Also, where was Melissa McCarthy in her career at this point? This was like pre-everything.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this was her being cast constantly as like a person who literally has one line.
Okay.
In everything.
Yeah. She's the only, well, other than like the villain who's still like a bit, I don't know, I feel like treats the angels as her equal. She's the only woman in it who feels a bit like anti-woman, because she like just turns around and calls Lucy a bitch for like not talking to her. But other than that,
right?
Like,
yeah.
There's this such great sense of camaraderie, and it's really this world in which women are on top all the time that I think is so fascinating.
Yeah, and first of all, as a gay man, it's like we love comedic, funny women, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these women are all so funny in different ways, and I think that's another thing that I love about the way that this movie is written. It plays to their comedic strengths too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're all very funny in very, very different ways, but they all get to really, like, just lean into whatever that is and showcase it, and it explodes on camera. Like, they all get, I think, very equal, like, special moments to be really funny.
Yeah. No, I think so, too. Like, even at the start when, because I think Cameron Diaz is a really good comedic actress who does not get her dues. I even think at the start where, is it Vivian West or Woods? I'm just thinking of Vivian Westwood now.
I'm like, Vivian Westwood?
I can't remember Vivian. I can't remember her surname, the villainess in this. She like badmouths her and is like, oh, she's the one who did it. And she walks into the room and then she has to sort of play this like, fuck.
Yeah.
I just think that's so well acted.
She's so great. Like she, nobody makes a character lovable the way Drew Barrymore, or not Drew, well, Drew too, Cameron. But Cameron yeah. Diaz, my God. Like that laugh, her smile in the camera. I mean, the amount of time that we spend panned on her face, just her face acting, her eyes and her giant smile and like her expressions, like they knew what they were doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of like a Cameron Diaz solo moment, can I ask you as a Black American, how do you feel about that scene where she gets up at the Soul Train party and just starts dancing and the crowd go white girl, go white girl? I'm just like, okay. It feels inauthentic.
It is so the year 2000. Like it's so the year 2000. It's so ridiculous, but she's such a believable character that she somehow makes that scene like so adorable. Like she makes that scene really fucking enjoyable, and it's just because she's so good. And I love when they cut like the moments where like in her mind she's killing it, and then they cut to what's going on and everybody's just staring and you can hear her feet tapping on the ground. It's so funny. Like she's just so goddamn funny.
Yeah. And actually when I watched that the second time, I was like, oh, so the crowd are actually cheering her on in a sort of like, look at this fucking idiot.
Yeah,
way, like which makes a lot more sense.
Yes. Yeah. Like she's an idiot, but she like is having fun. Like it's cute.
Yeah, she's just going so hard that she can't help but just be like, okay, let her go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like each one of them, they get like one real big moment. Like I think that's her like really big comedic scene, right?
Mm.
And then
Lucy, I'd say is when she's doing that like dominatrix,
yes,
inspirational talk.
Yes. Which is so Lucy Liu, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Like real, like never breaks, always a little stern face, and then like just so over the top and camp.
Yeah, so over the top and like delivering like a really intense monologue. She's so good at that. It gave me Kill Bill vibes.
Yes, again, yeah, which was same year before, around that time anyway.
Around that time for sure.
Mm. So what's Drew's comedic moment? Is it when she's back in Sam Rockwell's house?
See, I thought she had a couple, but I felt like the Rockwell, her in Rockwell's house was like the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Where she falls down the hill and she like, and then she like knocks on the door and she has the floaty. Like, that was great. Yeah.
Because in that scene, I thought it was so strange. Like, she, like, first of all, hideous house. I mean, we're all in inflation, but I wouldn't even buy that if it was on the market. Hideous house.
Oh.
But, like, she does this weird, I feel like she treats him like a child after, like, they go and they have sex, and then she's like, oh, stay away from the window, you'll fall out. It's like, first it's his house, surely he knows.
Right, I know.
It's like, we just fucked, now be careful. And even, like, when she turns around, you know, Vivian turns around with the gun, it's like, oh, be careful, and pulls him down onto the couch and spells out enemy using the Scrabble tiles. It's just like, why are you treating him like he's
high? And she even whispers it, enemy. It's like, babe, he can spell too and read and all that. Yeah, I think it plays to what you said earlier, that all the men are just supposed to be idiots.
True. Yeah.
And like the women are really like looking over them, watching over them. Yeah. You know,
out of all the love, like, so you mentioned us gay men, we love a funny woman, we also love a hot guy. Who's the most attractive to you of the love interests? So like Sam Rockwell, Matt LeBlanc, Luke Wilson. Let's throw Tom Green in there for the crack.
Okay. It would be funny if I was like, oh, it's Tom Green. Oh, no. Come on. The answer is Matt LeBlanc, right? That's the answer.
There's something about Sam Rockwell in this movie I really dig. The sort of goofiness. Okay.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
The answer is Sam Rockwell. Yeah, the actual answer is Sam Rockwell. You like Matt is there to confuse you, but the actual answer is Sam Rockwell. Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think as actors, I'd go for Matt, but as the characters, I'd go for Sam. There's just some sort of goofy, and when he does the sort of like the dance around, like I don't know, there's some sort of sexual energy he has that's charged there that gets me going.
And again, it's all of these people like being written to like play to their strengths, because like that character could have been really kind of like nothing. Mm-hmm. Like any other person playing that, it could have been like a really kind of drab, like kind of like stereotypical like villain, but he chose to play it in this really unique way where like at the end when he like reveals himself, he's like, it's like this weird Kaiser Sose moment where he's all of a sudden like the Shaft, like he's like doing the splits and like getting up, he's like smoking a cigar and like he's like cool all of a sudden. That was awesome.
Yeah, it goes full Tarantino for a bit, like even like the scene where he's tied Drew up and like puts the duct tape over her mouth but like draws the lips on it, like it's just like this really sort of like cool, I just again Kill Bill Tarantino touches to it that I felt that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, little sprinkles of things where you're like, well, that's fun, that's like a fun way to play this. And I love that scene in general too, like where like Drew like falls backwards out the window. It's such an abuse of technology, which is what I always say about the early 2000s. We were really leaning into the abuse of computers. We were so excited about being able to CGI things.
Yes. Well, actually, one thing I did want to say is our relationship with technology has grown a lot since this movie. Because even like, you know, this is the time where you can say things like, he's trying to hack the mainframe, and people go, oh, God, I know that's bad. But like, I think we know so much more about tech companies, about clouds, about monitoring, like this, what Red Star is some sort of SpaceX style satellite positioning company, and like this guy Knox has a voice recognition software and he's trying to pair the two of them together so if someone talks on the phone he can find them. But it's just like now you say those things and I think as real casual technological users, you're kind of like, well, does that really work? Like, I think we can fact check it a lot better than we could have back in 2000.
I totally agree with you. And I'm so happy at the beginning that you brought up that you're a James Bond girl, because I am too.
Okay. And,
okay. So like in the 2000s James Bonds, like the technology gave me very much that vibe where it's like, it's like, it has that feeling of being of like, we're in the future now. The future is now. It is the year 2000. We are using computers, you know? It's like very silly. And like, it thinks it's like very space age and far out of this world, but it's like very grounded in like a very simple reality that is easy to debunk. Like, it's not, like even like the silly stuff, like her putting her hand in like the goo and they're like, it has like full hand print technology or whatever, not just your fingers. So like the door lock is like, you put your hand inside goo and it's like lights going off. You're like, what's happening?
Yeah, and I can't remember, how did they get the scan of his hand? Because they dress up as those German Oktoberfest Lederhosen ladies and played the trombone to get his eye. I don't remember him getting the hand at any point.
Yes, like what? There's a light scanner inside the trombone that goes wing.
That can still produce music at the same time. It's a really handy gift.
Like, it's so silly, but it thinks it's like so space age, like so the year 2000.
And I hate to be like, I know no one really enjoys finding nerdy nitpick holes and things like that, but like the whole pressure pad floor, clearly again a nod to Mission Impossible.
Yeah,
but Mission Impossible, it was pressure padded when it was locked and he was going in when it was locked and ascending from the ceiling. They had unlocked the door, but yet the floor was still pressure padded. That made no sense.
Right. I know. And it lives in such a dream world that they don't even, like, even when she's doing like the backflips and stuff on the floor, she's on it for more than 2 seconds.
Oh yeah. They don't even try.
They don't even try. Because they know that this is just a big music video, which is fun. And also,
she lands the backflip in the flip. On top of something. Yeah. She flips up in the air and then lands on the hands. It's like, why?
Okay, let's talk about the fighting.
Okay, right.
Let's talk about the combat.
Well, one thing I did see is that Drew Barrymore didn't want any of the angels to use guns because she's very anti-gun. And I thought that was actually quite novel. And I watched it and I hadn't picked that up really until I heard it afterwards. I was like, oh yeah, the only gun you see is Sam Rockwell's gun, I think.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like they use everything in the room that they can, but they never use guns.
Yeah.
So obviously you're familiar with wire foo. The term, have you ever heard that term?
No, I vaguely, I probably would want a clarification.
Okay, so in the early 2000s,
some kung fu related,
yeah,
on a wire,
pretty much, yeah. Okay. Like it became really, really popular in the early 2000s because of The Matrix, like you said earlier. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was like major, and this movie honestly had a huge impact on this like style. And it's very early 2000s. I know that it, I looked it up online and it said that it came from like decades before. Obviously it was like, we just took it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Of course, American directors were like, oh, that's cool. We'll take that. And people like to shit on it. I mean, it looks very like dated now, but I think it's still really effective. I thought it was really cool. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought so. And it, like it presented violence in a way that didn't feel violent per se, because it just feels so choreographed, like it's basically sort of dancing. And you know, throughout the whole as a Bond gal yourself, you'll know, Daniel Craig will talk about how he'll go through 100 suits on different levels of scuffed up because he gets so scuffed up. In this, they would be kicking ass for about 5 minutes and like would look exactly the same. There's no scuff. Like they still look pristine. It just feels like this is just a fun choreographed fight that is to represent the violence that these women are going to do. So I quite like that. I think there's like an innocence to it.
That's exactly how I feel. There is an innocence to it. It makes it light, you know? It makes it feel like this is a movie that technically could kind of be enjoyed by, like, any age group.
Yeah.
Like, kids can watch this, I think, you know? It's, like, fine. And it's not, like, Kill Bill violent. Like, there's no blood or anything, really. No. It's just sound effects and, like, whoosh, whoosh. Yeah. Like it's just really like that, bam boom, you know,
like when they chase Crispin Glover down that back alley pretty much like maybe a half an hour into the movie and they play The Prodigy, Smack My Bitch Up, and you're like, okay, shit is going down here. And they're chasing him through different doors and they're breaking through glass and they're giving, like they're jumping out each other's hands to like spring up into the air. It's almost like take Olympic gymnastics and just put it into a dark street and give it a narrative and you're like, there you go,
yeah, we have it. It's so true. And I love that they like use each other as this like constant like sort of moving machine to like fight this person, like you said, like turning their arms into like a launching pad and then like, you know, Cameron Diaz bending over so Lucy Liu can jump on her back and then whatever, you know, like I love that they kind of fight as one. They're like a transformer kind of coming together.
And brings in that unity of the three of them together, that they are like, you know, hammer some of the mess that they are better, the three of them, than they are individually, like the sum of their parts and stuff. So
yeah,
like I do really appreciate it. It kind of, I guess it picks up again at the end where Drew's tied to the chair and she's like, I'm going to kick all your asses and I'm going to moonwalk out of here. And then she kicks all their asses and then they play Michael Jackson. And you're like, oh, well, you are having just as much fun as we are making this movie.
Do you have a favorite fight scene?
I think that one I mentioned in the Smack My Bitch Up one, I think. I just, because it just goes so hard and it's, Crispin Glover is such a creepy man that it's like, it's just kind of like, it's almost like symbolizing every woman who's been felt uncomfortable by the creepy man. Like this is their fantasy of kicking his ass with their friends. Like, I think that looks the best. I guess ultimately he gets away, but like, and with the creepy strands of hair as well. But I think that's my favorite.
I think it's my favorite too.
Yeah.
It's the scene I think I used to revisit the most as like a kid too. Like I would just sometimes just watch that scene. And I think it does a good job of introducing like the style of fighting, because it's the first real like big fight they have. And you get an idea. You're like, okay, this is a fantasy. Like,
yeah,
I can completely let go and just enjoy this like wild ride. Like they're flying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. Like, you know,
to be honest, rewatching it, it was when LL Cool J's face came off that I was like, okay,
no, I'm like halfway through the movie today. I'm like, oh, this isn't based on any kind of reality. It's like 50 minutes in. You're like, I noticed within the first couple seconds it was kind of art more so than.
But you're right, it sets the combat style.
yeah, and you're right, Crispin Glover is so, he's so good at making his characters just like uniquely weird and like strange and creepy, and the fact that they just refer to him as Creepy Thin Man is so funny to me.
It's like kind of, and even like we only see him take a lock of is it Lucy Liu's hair, but then by the end of it he has like a lock of all three of hairs. You don't know where he got them from, and you're just like, oh, creepy man with the hair,
and like the way that he like runs it across his face and then rubs it on his head and then puts it in his pocket. It's like so creepy.
It's so creepy, and like that sort of like almost like pre-ejaculatory like body jerk that goes with the sniff. It's just
pre-ejaculatory.
I mean, it is like that's exactly what it is. Oh yeah, he's creepy man. He comes back in the second movie, if I can remember correctly, right? Doesn't he?
I think so. I think he has a cameo.
Yeah,
weird. I definitely have not seen the second one as much as I've seen this one, for sure.
No. And like the second one's a whole other conversation, but Courtney Cox and that bad Irish accent, I mean.
And that fur with the guns. It's just like, what is this? but no, yeah. And that fighting scene specifically too, like, is just pure music video camp. I mean, it's just, and the fact that like Prodigy is playing, like, I can't believe that this movie wasn't, because I remember at the time MTV was like making films. And I'm surprised that this isn't an MTV film. It just feels like it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know who, maybe your man worked at, what was his name? Mick G?
Mick G.
Yeah. He obviously would have had, he must have worked at MTV in the past, whatever, if he was making music videos or with a sort of idea in mind if he wanted to get on MTV. So that's probably what spills across with that. But yeah, like it's 12s A. I don't know what the certificate ratings are over there, but it's like just over kids, but like bang on for teens.
I think for us that's like it's like PG-13. Like you can be 13 years old and go get a ticket.
Yeah, okay. So I mean that sounds right. It does feel like it's hitting teenagers more so than adults.
Now, there is a conversation to be had about this movie. And you and I talked about this a tiny bit before, but I really want I want to expand on your thoughts, because I have so many. So this is a movie that people have debated over the years, like whether or not this is like a movie that's to be presented through like the male gaze, or if this is in fact like this empowering, like feminist film or whatever. After watching it now, like where do you fall on that?
Yeah, so I mean, having spoken to some female friends about the movie, trying to work out like what, because I mean, I'm a man, I see things with a male gaze to a certain degree, and most movies are in a male gaze, so it was trying hard for me to parse the two of them. But watching it again specifically for this, I felt a lot of it was in the female gaze. I have like two little columns in my notes. I have under male gaze, I have lack of bra. None of those angels wants to wear a bra at any point, and from what I understand, that would make their life a lot more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The use of cars, again, obviously some women are into cars. I just felt that was very male gazy. They didn't need to have race cars. They didn't need to have fancy cars. I felt male gazy. But then under the female gaze column, I felt like there's that scene at the party where Lucy Liu's being hit on, but like, it always feels like she's in control. It's like this man groveling to be with her, and she's like, no, get away from me. It's like these women walk through life and they get all the benefits of being attractive, but they don't have any of the downsides of being attractive. They don't get, you know, they can defend themselves, so they don't have to worry about being creeped upon. They're excelling at their jobs. They don't have to worry about, you know, gender pay gap and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I feel it's really female gaze. I feel it's really kick ass. It's really you know, this is a female fantasy that the audience can live out, which is a woman who doesn't need to worry about all these threats, who can look after herself, can be both financially, independently, socially. I think it's really interesting that only one of the characters, Alex, Lucy Liu's character, seems to strive for domesticity. We never see, I don't think we ever see Drew's house. We see mm-hmm. Cameron Diaz's bedroom, which I noticed was filled with vinyls, which I thought was very 2022.
Yeah, yes.
But it's only Alex's character that seems to strive for domesticity and striving for this like double life where she's lying to her boyfriend and stuff. And I thought that was a really interesting choice. The other two didn't seem burdened by what age they were, whether they had kids, all that sort of stuff. They were freed mm-hmm. of those sort of societal shackles.
Well, you bring up so many good points. I didn't really think about the fact that we don't get to see a lot of their lives outside of like their job. Mm. And like they all have like one interest outside of being an angel. But like, I wrote in my notes that obviously, like you said, this movie is undeniably being viewed through a male gaze. And I think it was like directed through a male gaze.
Mm.
But I think it's undeniable that you can feel the intense involvement of a lot of women involved mm-hmm. in the production of this movie. You know, like there were a ton of female producers. Drew is the executive producer. The cast is mostly women. It just feels like they're sexy in this movie, but like into it and owning it. And like they're sexy because they want to be, like they're fucking feeling their oats. Like they're not being, it's not like Jiggle TV. It's not, you know, Coyote Ugly. Mm. It's not boob tube shit. It's like them being really, really sexy and powerful and cool and like being able to have costume changes and shit. Like it feels like they're very much in control of it the whole time. Like I even wrote like specifically the scene, there's so many scenes, but the scene where Drew gets in the car with the driver at the racetrack. Yeah. Like you can't tell me that Drew Barrymore wasn't absolutely like feeling herself. You can just feel it, you know, when she gets out and she's like strutting like away from the car, and you're like, Drew Barrymore was just excited that she got to be sexy and wear a blonde wig and like that they're like doing costumes, and you can just feel that they're just having fun. I feel,
yeah, I mean, you have to be feeling it if you're licking a steering wheel, you know, that's a level of commitment that you need to really commit to. But like even that scene is like, I'm so sexy, I've reduced this professional man into a blubbering idiot, and then I'm just gonna walk away and there's no repercussions for it. It's just like, it's this pure liberated, I think is the only word to feel. These women feel liberated in their sexuality, and they feel liberated in this world.
Yeah,
they can do whatever the fuck they want, and there's no repercussions. And I think that must feel so exciting for a female audience member.
Yeah, it's really, it's like you would think that as an actor, like it's a dream to be able to do something like this, and you can kind of feel that energy from watching them. First of all, they're all friends like in real life, and they're all like actually getting to hang out and do all this stuff. And I think that's another reason that it feels that it connects to people and that it connected to young people, is because you can actually feel the authentic friendships in this movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, knowing definitely. That they were friends outside of it, like that really added to it.
On that though, wasn't there some beef on set between Lucy and Bill Murray that he like shouted at her one time, or it was hard to know how deep that went?
Yeah, I don't know if they've ever really expanded on that. But I know for sure that they didn't get along. Mm-hmm. And he also wanted like a ton of money for the next one that they weren't willing to give him. So okay. They replaced him with Bernie Mac, I want to say. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I was wondering whether he got booted because of Lucy, which I would be like, wow, great. A man is being difficult. He gets kicked off a job with a woman's
face. I know.
That'd be gorgeous.
Drew's like, sorry, you're an icon, but you gotta go. Oh, yeah. Not this time.
So yeah, that's the only, hearing that like does sort of feel, did make me worry like, oh, maybe the atmosphere was awful behind stage. Because like you said, it does look like they're having so much fun in it.
Yeah, like it honestly feels like girls just like hanging out, you know? Mm. And I remember like the press tour for this movie was so fun too. Just watching Drew in Lucy and Cameron like go on talk shows together and go to TRL together and just like, oh, it was just such a fun time. Take me back. I don't want to live in this time.
Even someone we haven't even mentioned yet, Tim Curry, like his character swans in as a big old racist at, I wrote it down, Madam Wong's House of Blossoms, right?
Oh my God, Jesus Christ.
To get his massage, immediately calls Lucy Liu Yoko Ono straight away. And then like, you just get to watch him getting the shit kicked out of him and then ultimately killed. And you're like, okay, good.
Yeah.
That feels satisfying.
And like, his scene with Lucy Liu is so, also again, just Lucy Liu being so Lucy Liu, like the physical acting, like her like having a completely stone cold face while she's doing something insane, mm-hmm. like only she can do that, you know?
Yeah.
I wrote in my notes that I feel like this movie gets absolutely, the true climax of this movie where things get really buck and are very fun is when it's after the Soul Train thing, and when she goes to the bathroom and she gets attacked by that guy, when Cameron gets attacked.
Yeah.
And they finally, like, when they do, like, the bird thing, and they go to that, like, I don't even know what the hell that is. What is it, like, a castle?
Yeah,
what is that? Carmel
is, what, Northern California? I was like, this looks like France to me. I mean, maybe it does look like France there. I don't know. I'm not being there. But, yeah, it feels, I was expecting, you know, it looked like Monterey, not this Roman castle. It was very strange.
It was such a set piece for fighting. Like, it was just like, we are here to fight in this
And it's building. Also, it's like you're telling me in the year 2000, master digital criminals lock people up in literal dungeons.
Right. A literal dungeon, like literal, no sarcasm.
Again, you know, if we throw back to James Bond, that happens to Judi Dench in The World Is Not Enough. She's locked in a very similar thing, has to cobble her way out of there using a clock. So maybe it's not to that.
Maybe, honestly, it could have been.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that scene where Drew like explains to the guys how she's gonna kick their ass, and it's like so Drew.
Hmm.
Again, like,
I know in this scenario it's a physical combat, but I just feel, I can imagine that's a woman in her boardroom being like, I'm right, you are all wrong, and the men being like, oh, no, and then in fantasy she gets to like basically stand over them, you know, as the victor and be like, see, I was right. So again, you know, that's another example of like the perfect female fantasy this movie provides at times.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's great too when she's like, when she's trying to get the lighter to work and she's stalling by explaining what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And she's like, since I can't get my trusty lighter to work, I'm going to do this with my hand, my hands tied behind my back. Like, it's just great. It's just like, it's just so stylized and ridiculous that you're like, it's just fun.
And speaking of stylized, even like the post credit scene where they're doing this like Green Day cosplay, it's just like,
oh my god, why the hell not? Why not? I love that. Is one of my favorite moments. My god,
we've done everything else. I guess we can get into the costumes, and there is a bit of problematic nature to the costumes, but like, yeah, it's just like, why the hell not? Like, you just keep, you know, and then having some outtakes in the credits. It just has everything. It's just fun from the start to the end.
It's literally a buffet.
Mm.
It's a buffet, whatever you want, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the costumes.
Yeah, I felt there was definitely some casual racism through the movie, even from, like, the main characters. There's Gypsy garb belly dancing, and for some reason Drew is about three shades darker than the rest of the
women. Yeah, like, what?
So I was like, okay, that's blackfishing. Then there's geisha costumes to the song Turning Japanese. You're like, oh.
Oh my god, I know. And like, and you know the whole time in her mind Lucy Liu was like, this is psychotic. What the fuck is going on right now on this good day?
But like, it's, and you just kind of, and obviously I had like Natalie or Cameron Diaz dancing at the Soul Train in my notes as well, in this sort of like weird the girls can just go in and sort of take on a race and swan out as part of their disguises. I guess, you know, it could be true to some sort of spy-like things, but it's just they didn't need to go that hard, I guess, to a certain degree. When we look at it now, 22 years onwards, you're kind of like, you could have got away with just a kimono, I think. You didn't have to go full gaze.
Totally. It was like very, it just kind of shows you how, you know, when you see movies like this, especially like early 2000s and like late 90s movies that have these like uncomfortable moments with stereotypes, it just kind of shows you how surface we were at the time. Like, we were all very sort of shallow, like not very deep thinking people about anything, really.
Yeah,
like none of us thought deeply about any of these scenes at all, and they're so blatantly insane.
We were just such
a numb society.
They're just sort of like real like token markers of like, okay, they are adopting a culture as a costume. That's basically what they're telling us, that it ends up being like the lowest form. And it's also kind of just like, we need some way for them to be dancing. Let's make them belly dancers. Oh, great idea. Yeah. The costumes. Like, that seems to be how much thought was put into it.
Yeah. It's like literally, that may have even been a little bit too much thought. I mean, you may have even overdone it.
I'm sorry. I'm assuming the best of Mick G.
McG, and like, sir, is it time to change your name? Probably, right? You think so? Like, when you're directing some 41 videos, it's one thing, but you're a movie director now, McG, enough.
Can you imagine? And nominees for best director in at the Academy Awards, McG for Mick Charlie's G. Angels. It's just, no. Yeah, when you see someone under like
four.
You need to up your LinkedIn, babe. It's like, you're not looking professional enough on that. He needs to spruce up Mick G.
It still says that you just did a Gap commercial. That was old, right? It's like 20 years old.
Yeah.
So. But no, so aside from the very, like, of course, inappropriate costumes, because it's the year 2000, and what would a movie be without them? There are some really incredible costume changes, and I love the contrast of them, like Drew with like her like Kool-Aid red hair and her red lip, and she's like kind of pale, and then of course like California Beauty Cameron Diaz, and then dark, like they just all like contrast each other in such a really unique way. It really is like Powerpuff Girls.
It really is. And I remember, I don't know what made my 10-year-old, 12-year-old self, whatever it was, after I watched this movie, I said to myself, if I have a daughter, I'm going to call her Dylan.
It's the best name.
I was like, it's so kick-ass. It's like, it's a boy's name, but like, it works so much better for a girl because it sounds so unique and so spunky.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it was like, I think actually all the names work perfectly, like Natalie, Alex, and Dylan. Like, I think you've hit it on the head there with all those names. And the sense of character that they each have obviously works to that as well.
I wish that we got a full, and it is just 1 second, but the scene where they're army crawling and recreating like the iconic Charlie's Angels moment where they're all handcuffed to each other. That's the only scene from Charlie's Angels I've ever seen, because it's like very famous.
Okay. Yeah.
And I love that moment for some reason. I just like love the costume. They just look so cute.
How did you find Cameron and Lucy in drag? Oh, sorry, Cameron and Drew in drag. When they do boy drag and they hide the little beards. I was like, Cameron's a really sort of sexy nerd.
Can we talk? I was like, am I sexually attracted to Cameron in this like prosthetic weird face lace front
belty beard thing? Yeah,
like a merkin. Yeah. On her face.
She like looked hot. I saw Drew straight away. That's Drew Barrymore as a boy.
Yeah.
And then I went, so that must mean that man is Cameron Diaz. Hello. Yeah.
It's like, some people are just beautiful no matter what.
Exactly.
No matter what. You put a bag on her head and she's still stunning.
Yeah. So yeah, I thought like that's such a fun thing to do as well. Like, they've gone through so much costumes. They were like, after we did the belly dancing, let's make them men. Why not? That's really fun.
I love in that scene too when Lucy's giving her speech and she like whips Drew's crotch with the whip and she goes, ow. No, do you have like a favorite? Do you have a favorite look? Actually, tell me your favorite look for each girl. It doesn't even have to be in the same scene. Your favorite look for each one.
That's so tough. So it's Lucy Liu has this lovely asymmetrical red dress, I think, at the party that they go to where they sneak backstage. I think that's possibly her best. I was sort of put off by her leather dominatrix look, only because whatever Foley artist was working on it was really overdoing the leather crinkling noises. Like, she was standing perfectly still and it's like,
like, if you're making that much noise by walking, there's a problem. It's like, all right.
That kind of made my skin crawl to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I can't, that's one that really stands out. I'm very bad visually. You throw out some and I might remember them then. I remember a lot of bikinis for Natalie.
Yes.
A lot of like really, really skimpy bikinis. And I feel I really liked what Dylan wore, but I can't picture any of it now in my head. I don't have it in my mind's eye.
So I love the like race car driver thing on Drew.
Oh, actually, yeah. Now did you say it? In that car, Drew, I've never seen Drew's boobs look so good as she does in that car.
Oh my God. She looked so cool. She looked like a Grand Theft Auto girl.
Yeah. No, she did. Like, I don't know what way they were pushed up, but like with the leatherette, like body jumpsuit or whatever. Yeah, that's actually a brilliant look. And her hair looks great in that as well.
Oh my God, I know. Mm. Love Drew as a redhead. Like, Drew, please. Like, I really liked her as a redhead. Just fit perfect. Cameron.
Natalie goes brunette for a bit as well, doesn't she? She goes brunette. Yeah. And I feel like kind of works for her too.
Yes, I love that. I mean, Cameron looks good in fucking everything, but I have a very special place in my heart for at the end when they're on the beach and she's wearing that, like, she literally looks like she's in Sports Illustrated. She's wearing this like cropped blue button-up blouse, like tied up with like that high-waisted bikini bottom, and she just looks like a gazelle.
She does. She looks like a proper Victoria's Secret model flouncing around on that beach. Yeah.
Yeah, she's
speaking
so cool.
About that scene, I find it confusing. Why did they include that little bit where like Drew Barrymore looks over her shoulder and she's like, oh my God, that old man's Charlie, but I'm not gonna say anything. That felt a bit, why include that? I was confused.
I think that it was supposed to represent like because he's supposed to be like a dad to her or something, because you remember when Sam Rockwell says like, oh, it's another father that you'll never meet.
Yes. Okay.
Because I'm gonna kill him. I think that it's supposed to be like, he's our dad and like he's watching over us, his angels. It's very you know, it's a very half-assed B plot.
Yeah. Oh, it's an L plot. Like,
it's it didn't make the alphabet.
That's why I felt weird, because it's kind of just like, oh, there he is. Oh, because all of a sudden it's like, will we get to meet him? Oh my God. But
there was one other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about that I was obsessed with, and it was the way that they built this world to kind of be like, it's the future, it's the year 2000, but also it's like kind of timeless, like it's kind of the 70s too.
That's actually a very good point, because obviously that's a tie back to the original movie. I mean, I guess they didn't know how much they were aging it with the flip phone, because like you could pinpoint that to a year if you grew up in the 2000s.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, you're right. And I guess maybe that ties back to the castle. It ties back to like the sports cars. Like, you don't really see, because it's also overhyped and so cartoonish. It does sort of lose a certain essence of like the mundane, like what, Bush and the White House, all that sort of stuff. Like, you lose all that. It's really sort of just like, it's a dream world, sort of. So it feels outside to the world that it actually was created in. All right.
Yeah, it's a total dream world. Like, at the beginning in Drew's dream, her actual dream, when she's fantasizing that she's like at a disco and that the whole thing revolves around her. And then, you know, she wakes up and she's wearing like that like vintage baseball t-shirt, and like you said, she has records in her house. They just do little things to inject that sort of 70s vibe, like even the fact that they still talk to him on like that very dated little speaker box, like random little touches like that, you know.
Even that office is quite 70s, I feel, like with the chrome and like all the wood from panels and little patterns and stuff, like and like, who is it who makes the cupcakes? It's Alex, right? Makes the cupcakes.
Yeah, Alex. That are like concrete.
They break through the door. It's like, what? Yeah, like they, it is strange. And even it's like the plot, the bad guy is like, I'm just going to use this technology just to kill a guy who I think killed my dad. Like that feels so old school in terms of its storytelling. But yeah, they use modern day technology to try get you there. So that is a nice meeting of the two. And do you know what I actually really appreciate in this world of social media apps, you know, turning us into information, I appreciated that the angels stole the software, but they wouldn't give it away. They were like, no, that'll be unethical. We're going to look and see if there was any evidence of foul play, and we'll give you that evidence. I was like, come here, our safeguarders of privacy. Charlie's Angels.
And they were so casual about that too. They were like, well, no, we would never do that.
No. And in fact, it's unprofessional of you to even ask that, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. That was great. I liked that too. I honestly had never caught that until this time.
No.
I guess I wasn't looking for that when I was 13, though.
No. online digital privacy was not on my bingo card as a young gay male.
I was like, Cameron, are you using a VPN?
Yeah. How do you really those know? Cookies?
Yeah, are you really being protected? I'm trying to think if I have any other things that I absolutely have to say, because I'll never get this opportunity ever again.
Well, I think let's just reminisce on the music itself.
Oh, okay. Yes.
There's so many good songs that like, I wish I took them down now, you know, to reminisce them all. I think like even something like Smack Your Bitch Up is like, it's so on the nose that it's like, you know, the music they cast is so on the nose. It's so like kind of almost basic, but they do it so well that it's like, that this actually works perfectly. They kind of set the scene around the music rather than the other way around, I feel. And even that song, like the Barracuda song that Lucy Liu's stomping through that office too, is just so much fun. What other songs stand out to you now from the soundtrack? Because there's so many.
Well, I think it's funny that you say that you know, it's like him being a music video director. It's like he probably did base those scenes around the music, because that's like kind of all he had ever really known. And it really works. Like you can feel that, like you said, even though the songs do feel kind of basic, like Smack My Bitch Up is like, okay, we're doing a fight scene to Smack My Bitch Up, but it's so choreographed around the music that it's like, it works really well.
Yeah. And I think like it's Baby Got Back, I think, that Cameron does her Go White Girl dance.
Oh, yes, 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 yeah.
That it's like, I just imagine, you know, when that song came out, it was a load of white people trying to twerk effectively, and black people being like, what? And it's like, that's exactly the message being given in that scene as well, so it like echoes the song perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that scene is so great with the music. And also when Cameron wakes up and it plays Heaven Must Be Missing an Angel, come on.
Got to Give It Up, that Marvin Gaye song that Blurred Lines got that's in it as well, which is great, which I didn't remember that being it from the first time. I was like, okay, this works really well.
Yeah, the soundtrack is incredible. Another reason that it just reminds me of an MTV movie. I'm like, this just feels like, you know, even the fact that they got the rights to all these songs feels like it would be produced by MTV.
And then I love that every Charlie's Angels iteration has to spruce up the old 70s soundtrack for the end credits, you know? Because I think such a banger of a theme tune.
It's so good. It's so recognizable too, right? Like, it's just so iconic. And
I kind of feel like I shouldn't be standing still listening to that. I should be sprinting down a road after like some old lady who dropped her bag.
Right, you should be like laying a coat down at least for somebody to cross the street or something. Exactly, something gentlemanly.
Just makes me want to do something good at pace. That's all. Absolutely. I want to do.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, obviously the lore of this movie, like the Destiny's Child theme song, added so much to it, right? Like it added so much to the hype and the excitement and, you know, just the pandemonium around this movie, like those two things combined. Oh my god. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. And then like for the second one, because Independent Woman doesn't really get its space in the movie.
No.
Like, wait, when Pink's Feel Good Times is in the second one, there's like the whole scene of the motorbike racing happening, and like Pink's boyfriend at the time is in the scene and stuff. It's like, I kind of would have loved to have seen that Destiny's Child song in the movie, because
yeah,
it, you know, it already is so hand in hand with the movie as it is. I would have just loved to seen, I don't know, like make a scene around that. Like, I think it would have worked seamlessly.
I agree with you. We only get the background of it during the scene where they go through the fast food window.
Yeah.
You don't get any moment or anything where they like fight to it or anything, or even do like a montage to it would have been great.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
yeah, missed opportunity.
Missed opportunity for sure.
So when I was saying to you before we were recording, my friends and I, we choose a muse every year, and we watch a movie of that muse every month. And 2021 was Drew Barrymore, so we watched Charlie's Angels. So that's when the last time I watched it. But after the movie, we rank it under different categories. So do you want me to talk you through some of the categories?
Can you please? I'm dying to hear this.
Okay. Right. So we give a score out of 10 to all the movies, and then we choose, yeah, at the end of the year, we have a little award ceremony. We go out for dinner. I print off the little piece of paper we read and count down our favorite movies.
This is amazing.
Because I can't do anything and not rank it for some reason. I'm just a nerd.
We're homosexuals. Like, it's what we do. It's what we do.
So there was a score out of 10 for plot. We gave it 6 out of 10. Would you think that's fair?
I would say so for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a bit wacky, but it's enjoyable and, you know, whatever. Characters, 8 out of 10. I think they're strong.
You know, I think that's even good.
Acting, 8 out of 10.
Listen. It is. I mean, for this movie, like, it is.
Yeah.
Comedically.
Like, they're playing, you know, in a certain way. They're not playing it overly sincere. They're playing it with a glint in their eye. So I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Fashion, 10 out of 10. I mean.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was a little nervous, but okay. Good. Good girls.
Cinematography. Now, I think we overmarked this. This is 9 out of 10. When I rewatched it, I was like, there's definitely some dodgy things that haven't aged too well in that. But
yeah, I
that
agree.
That feels high.
I actually, when I was watching this, I was thinking, God, if they like remade this and they kept like the wire foo, but like updated like the cinematography, that would be so cool, you know?
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah, in hindsight, that was probably a bit high. We were obviously just swept up in our enjoyment of it.
Yeah.
Soundtrack, 10 out of 10. I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, totally.
Enjoyability, 9.5 out of 10. I don't know why we specified that half. There's obviously, okay. There's obviously one thing that pissed us off. Maybe it was creepy hair, man, that we were like, didn't enjoy him. Now we have one category that's called LPH, lols per hour.
Okay.
I don't know why we called it that. Basically, how funny it was. We only gave it a 5 out of 10 for comedy.
Okay, now that I have a problem with.
I don't know why we came up. Like, actually, I got more. I must have got laughed more the second time.
Yeah, we've hit a bump on the road. I'm sorry, but we've unfortunately hit a bump on the road.
So, if you were to correct our score, what would you give it out of 10 for comedy?
For comedy, and I'm not even being sarcastic, I'd probably give it an 8.
Hmm.
Because the performances are almost only comedic the whole way through. And like, it's funny dialogue and a lot of physical comedy, which is hard, you know? I would give it pretty high.
I think I appreciate its comedic effect more now after having watched it again in a quick succession, that there's even like Madame Wong's House of Blossoms. Like, a racist joke, but like, you know, I can see what it's going for there.
They're trying to do something.
It's so, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I would agree with you. I'd go like 7 or 8 in hindsight. Feminist, we went for 9 out of 10. I think
that
stacks up with our conversation. And then our final category is percentage of Drew. The movie was Drew in. We went for 7.
Yeah, I think that's good.
I think that's fair. So overall, it got 8 out of 10, and it was our favorite Drew Barrymore movie of the year. That movie.
Wow. Did you? What other? Do you watch just? Do you pick one movie to like kind of represent, or do you watch a bunch?
No. We do pretty much a movie a month, and actually, I think we got you more that year because it was a lockdown.
Makes sense.
So I'll talk you through the other movies you did. E.T.
Okay.
Blended.
Okay.
He's Just Not That Into You.
Okay.
Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. That was a dud. Didn't like that one. Never Been Kissed. Music and Lyrics. 50 First Dates. Going the Distance. I don't know if you've seen that movie. Loved it.
It's pretty good.
I loved a lot of it. The Stand-In. I really wanted to watch a contemporary one. And that came out, I think, in 2021, where she's basically playing like a double version of herself. One's famous, one's not. And the non-famous one stands in for the famous one. It wasn't very good. Ever After. Did you see that one in the 90s?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The Cinderella. That was actually, that one was a surprise hit.
It's really sweet.
Yeah, because we watched the trailer and the trailer went from like prodigy music into like Celtic flute music.
Yeah.
Like, wow, what a pivot. This is gonna be awful. But actually it was a hit. Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle, Wedding Singer, Scream, Riding in Cars with Boys, Donnie Darko, Fever Pitch.
Riding in Cars with Boys. Mwah.
Yeah, that's also kiss. Also a surprise favorite. So the top three. Of course, I have a spreadsheet for this. So number three was Never Been Kissed. Two was Riding Cars with Boys. Number one was Charlie's Angels.
Can I suggest one to you?
Okay. I mean, we're in Jennifer Lopez year now, but go on.
Oh, I've got one for that too.
Luckily,
I can't shut the fuck up. So that's like, no matter who it is, I'll have something to say. Okay. So for Drew,
mm-hmm.
I really highly suggest a movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's called Mad Love.
No.
So Drew plays a manic pixie dream girl at peak manic pixie dream girl era. It's like 94 or 5. It's like short haired Drew, bleached, flashing her tits on Letterman, flower power, chokers, like everything. And she plays this young girl who's bipolar. Mm-hmm. And she gets into a relationship with this boy, and they're young, and like he's trying to navigate her being bipolar. And it's like really, really, it's one of Drew's best performances. It's so emotional.
Okay.
And it's like, oh.
94, so she's still like teen.
She's like rebellious, like hanging out with Courtney Love, chain smoking Drew.
Okay.
She's nice.
Okay.
Yeah. Like her boobs are out all the time.
because I really didn't like in my canon of Drew Barrymore before that year, she went from E.T. to Charlie's Angels, and she did nothing. I didn't know anything she did in between.
Wow,
that was her journey for me.
I love that you did that then, though. That's great.
Yeah, so no, it's such good fun to go explore somebody, an actress. Yeah. It started with Hilary Duff, then we did Lindsay Lohan, Drew Barrymore, Jennifer Lopez. So
can I suggest a Jennifer Lopez movie too?
Do.
Okay. So there's one movie that nobody is going to suggest this to you, but I'm telling you, it'll change your life. Just listen to me. It's called U-Turn.
Okay. I've seen it on the list. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Cool. It is one of those movies that has like 90 people in it. Billy Bob Thornton. There's a million people in it. And it's really, really, really sort of noir, like whodunit, murder plot. Okay. Twist and turn, told a bunch of different ways from different perspectives.
Okay.
And it's one of her best movies. She's like very new in it, and it's like you'll never forget it.
Right. I'll message you when I watch it. I'll
okay.
I'll let you know where it is.
Well, do you have any closing thoughts about this movie?
Well, did you see the Kristen Stewart version of Charlie's Angels?
Okay, so I tried. I've tried to watch it like maybe twice okay. from home. I didn't go see it in theaters, and it just is bad. I don't like it. I'm going to probably try and watch it again now that I've so recently seen this.
Yeah, and I think I might do as well, because again, that soundtrack, Don't Call Me Angel, hello.
Yes, we talk.
It kills. Yeah, I'm interested in just sort of like a thought, like just as a comparison piece, just in terms of like, I know they've got a lot wrong, but I don't know what it is yet. So I'd be interested just to see in comparison that I've seen it so often, because the second movie gets, I don't know, it doesn't have the same magic to the same degree. Like, I think it pushes the wackiness a bit too far. Like, I still remember there's a scene where I think they're escaping the roof from the dodgy Irish criminals, and some wood explodes and they all grab a pallet of wood and they throw it down at their feet and they down a rope. You're just like, oh, for God's sake. Like, for some reason I'm allowed to forgive LL Cool J Mask, but I'm not allowed to forgive this pure disgrace, like pure middle finger to physics that you're giving me here.
You're right. Actually, I take back what I said earlier about this movie being an assault of an abuse of technology. It's that one.
Yeah.
That is the one that abuses technology in a way that is just like, is this a fucking Orbitz commercial? Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Or is this a movie? Like, what's happening?
A bit too far. Yeah. I'd love to see a reboot of these versions of Charlie's Angels. I'd love to see, but maybe it's not the same. Maybe they need to be kick ass. You know, maybe all the conversations about having like an older Bond or whatever, a female Bond, whatever. Like, if there were older women still kick ass, like that would still be, I feel that would be exciting, but maybe they will be limited as actors in terms of what they can do physically. But
I thought about that too, though. Like, if there was a world where we could like recreate this magic, you know, with this cast. And I feel like that's doable. Like, I think it would be really relatable to have the Charlie's Angels be women, like adult women, grown-ass women, you know, it'd be cool.
And part of me just wants to see the three of them go on dates. Like, I'm just interested in their characters. Like, I just feel like they have such a great sense of character that I'm like, I just want to be in their world, you know.
Yes.
In a way, now that like everything gets a spin-off if it's popular, I want to be in their world more. Those three friends, how do they become friends? What is the office politics like? Like, there's just so much to their world that sounds so intriguing. And this whole fight the bad guy thing, although it's good, I'm like, that's kind of to a certain degree one of the least interesting things about you. I want to know more. So I wish they got a spin-off like that.
I agree with you. The most interesting stuff is when they're just hanging out, like the fast food scene, the scenes where they're just like being silly with each other are my favorite.
So maybe they can try and make a TV show again or something, but they need to get actors with good chemistry.
It's the chemistry. They gotta cast like friends to do it, like people who are already like, you know.
Okay, Mick G comes to you, Troy McGee.
Oh god.
And he's like, we're casting Charlie's Angels 2023. Who are you casting?
Oh god, the cast of Euphoria.
The first thing that came to my head was Zendaya, right, straight away.
No, like literally
Zendaya, Sweeney, what's her name?
And what's her name with the dark
Hunter
hair?
Schaefer.
Yes, the cast Euphoria.
Yeah.
Hello. Come on, boys, punch the numbers and get the books going. Let's get it going. Let's get Mickey on the line.
That was easier than I thought.
Well, Keenan, I'm so glad that we got to do this finally. Me too. So worth it.
Thank you
it.
For having me.
It's been exciting. God, it was so much fun. Tell people where they can find you and your podcast and everything.
Yes. So if you are a Drag Race fan, my friend James and I release an episode after each episode discussing it, getting guests on, and that's called Sissy That Pod, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy deep dives on movies, music, a lot of the stuff that Troy does here, we do it from a different point of view. It's from a queer perspective. We analyze movies, TV shows, music videos, etc., from a queer point of view. So our season one just wrapped. We did Barbra Streisand's Guilty album. We did George Michael's Outside video. We did Clueless. We did Moonlight. loads of just content out there, and it's a really deep dive, and we're really, really proud of it. So that podcast is called Queer Classified.
Well, my listeners are going to be obsessed with that, first of all. Consider more than half of them already subscribed, I promise you. But yeah, this was so much fun. I already can't wait to have you back.
Super. I'm trying to work out which James Bond is the one we tackle next, is what I'm excited about.
We will talk.
Oh, you'll talk.
Trust me, I already can't wait to message you about James Bond. I like want to right now. But yeah, you guys, I hope that you enjoyed it. I will see you next week, and bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Dunzo. This podcast is a part of the Solid Listen Network. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Also, be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/solidlisten for exclusive content. You can follow me on Twitter at Troy McGee, and you can follow the podcast on all forms of social media at Dunzo Pod. That's D-U-N-Z-O. Thank you to executive producer Molly McAleer and coordinating producer Nicole Matthew.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.